That's it, the wrapping, that's what did it. Wow, pretty good. Okay. Alrighty, so anyways, so the last thing we left off was with the two cots. The cot that, that believes everything Chazal say, and then the cot that doesn't believe anything they say. Right, so we said the cot that's the second cot that degrades Chazal, they're arrogant, right? So since they're arrogant, so the Rambam says that they're worse off, right? Because an arrogant person cannot gain knowledge, because he's the prerequisite for knowledge is that a person admit that he doesn't know something. Okay, but the only question is, so then what about the first cut? What is their defect? I mean, the defect of the second cut is the arrogance. Fine. So does the first cut have a defect? The first cut accepts everything that Chazal say, all the Midrashim literally, and like the Rambam says, Nasu Etzlam Kohan Nimnos, to them every impossibility is Mechuyave HaMetzios, is necessary, is an actual, they make the impossibility the exact opposite. Anything that's impossible, if it's in Chazal, it becomes something that must exist. Right? So what's their, so do they have a defect? Is it just a lack of knowledge, or what's their thing?
Why do they automatically accept it? Because Chazal, they have a zeal of Chazal, Chazal can be wrong?
Right. Now it's Chazal, they accept all the Chazal. Whatever Chazal say, they accept, so on the surface he'd say, you know, maybe that's, it's not a totally crazy thing. I mean, it's a rational thing. I mean, they see Chazal Chachamim, right? They see the Chachamim, knowledgeable people, and therefore they say, well, we're going to listen to what they say. I mean, they're great Chachamim, and let's follow what they say. Let's listen to everything they say. So anything Chazal say, they accept as being true. You know, no matter how, even though on the surface it seems an impossibility, they accept it as literally as true. So what's the, so on one hand you say that, okay, but they have the correct idea that they really recognize the Chazal and Great Chachamim. So what is there, so is there a problem? I mean, apparently there's a problem with them, right? What would you say is the defect? Yeah?
A person has the ability to question things. It doesn't make sense to
them. Okay. So they don't question.
I mean, they're just simple-minded.
Okay. You mean they don't question? Well, they don't question. That's true. I mean, they don't question. So what? Why are they not questioning? In other words, is it because are they all simple-minded? Is it because of the lack of ability?
Maybe they would question it if a regular philosopher said it.
Right. In other words, are they just lacking the ability to formulate questions?
Or well, they don't know that they're supposed to. They don't even know that they're supposed to question.
Okay. So from what does that stem? That the fact that they're missing that information that they're supposed to question. From what is there a defect from which that stems? In other words, one possible defect is a lack of intelligence. They have a lack of intelligence. They simply don't question anything. But if you study this group, you'll see there's very intelligent people that belong to this group. So there must be another defect that prevents them from knowing that they're allowed to question.
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with that really, but it could be that they misunderstand what a question is, because
I'm sorry, I
misunderstand what a question is.
Okay.
If they would see a question just that's leading you to more knowledge, then there would be nothing to no problem. They might see the question as like an attack on themselves. So these are the authorities that hold up all their beliefs.
Right.
They misunderstand a question to being an attacking kind of
right, okay. So therefore, what's the defect? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the defect?
Their insecurity in their own beliefs. Because if they think a question is an attack, and now they don't want to ask it because they're insecure right. In their own beliefs.
Okay, so you're going into the psychology, right? But I'm saying, in terms of, not psychology, just in terms of their action, what kind of defect is it? In other words...
Do you stick with the authority of Chazal?
The authority. In other words, they follow authority, right? They're following authority. They are influenced by authority. The acceptance of authority, that is their thing. They accept authority. Okay? It could be for many psychological reasons, right? But their defect is, the defect in thought is the acceptance of authority. Another, yeah.
Well, everyone accepts, I mean,
okay.
Sure then,
yeah. Right. In other words, their thing is, right, that they accept Chazal as authority, right? And therefore, what do they do? What do they do with that? In other words, they accept Chazal, yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say, once you accept Chazal as your only authority, I think it's based on like a distorted view of religion. Like, all religion is just accepting authority, and then that's it. And that's the end. So if they just accept Chazal, they don't question it, they just think, it's definitely good, so then, I mean, that's where they go wrong. They don't even have to question it, because that's what religion is to them.
Even a regular halachic guy would accept authority, even if doesn't. Thinks, even if you think into Chazal, you're still accepting authority.
Not necessarily.
You're not accepting authority.
Oh, well, what's authority? I'm saying authority of just believing everything they say is different from accepting a halachic, you know.
I know, but both of them accept authority. They just don't understand what that means to accept authority. Like, they don't understand what the authority is trying to tell them.
Okay, well, let's just describe what's going on, right? What the Ram what this cut is, right? So this cut. What's responsible for why they don't question something that's irrational, that's impossible to the mind, right? What is responsible for that? It is their relationship to the authority, right? In other words, they're listening to this authority and they're accepting everything he says, right? So that's an absolute acceptance of authority. That is their, in other words, their underlying principle of operation is an absolute acceptance of authority. So therefore, if Chazal tell you something that is totally, in other words, the evaluation of a statement is not based on the statement itself, right? The normal way an intelligent person evaluates a statement is based on the merits of the statement, right? But there's another way to evaluate a statement, based on the source of that statement, the person that the statement is generated from. Right? Okay, so therefore what they're saying is that the only way to evaluate the statement is based on an absolute acceptance of authority. That's what they're saying, because they're saying it doesn't matter, the statement, the nature of the statement is irrelevant. It doesn't matter, they tell you black is white, that doesn't matter. We don't evaluate a statement based on the merits of the statement itself, but based on an absolute acceptance of authority. That's what they're saying. Right? That's their underlying premise. Okay? Right? Now, once you have that premise that these people are absolute authorities, we have to follow an absolute authority, so then, and no matter what he says, then it's irrelevant in the nature of the statement. Right? So that's isn't that the underlying premise that they're operating with? It's an absolute acceptance of authority. Yeah.
What's a healthy viewpoint?
Well, okay, I don't know. In other words, we know what their thing is, right? Their thing is an absolute acceptance of authority. Right? Once you have that, so then it doesn't matter what comes out of the person's mouth. Then the impossible could become the absolute reality. Right? The question is, does this mean to say that authority, that there is no idea, there should not be an idea of authority? In other words, that authority should not play a role. Is that what that means? In other words, what they're doing is they're saying authority is absolute. Okay? Now, what you're questioning is, does that mean that if I say authority is, if I say that premise is false, to say that authority is absolute, that premise is false, does that mean that I'm saying that authority is not a factor at all? No. That doesn't necessarily follow. Right? That doesn't necessarily follow. In other words, you could take a factor and take it too far. Right? That doesn't mean the factor is not a factor. It doesn't play a role in evaluating statements. It may play a role in valuing statements, but a limited role, doesn't mean it has to play an absolute role. Right? So therefore, it doesn't exclude to say that this is false, which we know is false, to take a person and say this person is an absolute authority, that anything he says must be true, That we know can't be, right? But the fact that we say that that is not a correct approach, that doesn't mean that we cannot use authority as a factor in evaluating something. That doesn't follow. Right? Like, correct?
Is that the other group? The first group?
The first group was the one that accepts Chazal literally, even if they tell you impossible things.
Oh, the other group, I mean?
The second group is the group that degrades Chazal.
Are they the ones that take the totally opposite approach to authority?
They take the totally opposite approach to authority. That's right, exactly. They say that authority, they take authority and say they're nothing. The two groups really are the exact opposite. They go to the opposite extreme. One group takes authority, makes them a demigod. That's it. You cannot question anything they say. That's one extreme, right? The other extreme is, no, this authority, these authorities are nothing. Anything they say is stupid. Okay? These are two opposite extremes. That's exactly what they are. The two katim are two opposite extremes of the rule of authority. Yeah.
By the second group, we explain that the reason why they're rejecting authority is because of their own ego.
That's right.
By the first one, do we have a character flaw that makes them take this logical flaw of saying that, oh, I'm supposed to believe everything Chazal says? Or is it just that happens and they should have thought more, but they didn't, so they're less intelligent individuals because of it? But it's not a result of a character flaw. It's definitely bad and wrong, but it's not a result of a character flaw necessarily, it's just the way their cards played.
What do you think? What do you say about that? Now, his question is that we said the second group, right, are Balei Gaiva. That's why they deny authority, right? The Balei Gaiva. And the first group are the exact opposite. They accept authority in an absolute way, right? But is there a character flaw that's associated with that way of operating?
They also think that it's supposed to accept authority.
Supposed to accept authority. That is what a person is supposed to accept, and Chazal, you have to accept them as 100% authority, absolute, no matter what they say. Right? Okay, is that based on character flaw? That's your question. In other words, second group is based on character flaw of arrogance.
Seems like holding on to such a false idea like that must come from a certain character flaw, but it would be hard to tell exactly what kind of flaw it would be.
Right, I mean, it's right. In other words, it's some mida that they have a over-attachment. There's an over-attachment to authority, right? There's an being overawed by the authority where you can't question anything. That is, we don't necessarily have to go into there could be various reasons why the person has this, right? But that is his tendency is to overestimate and accept the authority. I mean, let's leave it like that because that's a framework we could deal with. In other words, it's an overacceptance of an absolute acceptance of authority, right? Yeah.
I was going to say a reason because it could be many reasons.
I mean, it could be a lot of reasons. I mean, it's right. That's psychology, right? That's a psychological thing. Okay, why they do that? But that there is a tendency in man to do that, right? Okay. Right, to the degree where they accept the impossible as being the necessary. Okay? They'll accept the contradiction. Doesn't matter. Okay? So it's really two opposite, the two opposite katam, right? and it's opposed, the opposition is based on how you relate to an authority. Okay? So the Rambam says that this group, the first group, that has an absolute acceptance of authority, they're closer to the truth. Then the second group that rejects authority in an absolute way. Right? So we said because the one that rejects authority in an absolute way is based on arrogance. So arrogance is a mita that prevents a person from understanding ideas, right? Okay? But you can look at it a different way also, right? That the why is the first group in some sense is closer to the truth than the second group. And without going into psychology, right, or mitos. Well, the first group in some sense is closer to the truth than the second group. The first group are the ones that have absolute acceptance of authority. And the second group is the ones that absolutely reject the absolute rejection of authority. Right? So the Rambam is saying the first group is closer to the truth. Right? Yeah.
Well, most things that they're going to be hearing, which are not these things that are really impossibilities, they accept them right away. It happens to be, they didn't analyze it, but it happens to be the truth. So they accepted it and will try to live their life by at least an action.
Right.
And therefore will be living the better life.
Right, okay. Yeah.
But also the first group recognizes something beyond themselves that's instructing them. So right. If we could find a way to replace that instruction or point out something about that instruction, that would help. But the second group will not listen to anyone else. They just have to beat themselves.
That's right.
In order to get to the truth.
Right. Now, the first group is closer to the truth because it is true. They're great chachamim. The only thing is they overestimate. They're overestimating the role of the chacham, but they have a recognition that this person is a chacham and wisdom comes from this person. That is true. And the thing is, they're not dealing with that factor properly, right? But they have the factor. But the second group, because of their problem, they don't have the factor. They say this is not a source of knowledge. This area is not a source of knowledge. They're totally closed off to a real source of knowledge. So they have to be further away from the truth. Right? Because they lack knowledge of the actual knowledge they don't have. They don't have the wisdom, right? And they don't know the source of the wisdom, right? The first group does not have the wisdom, true, right? Because they misunderstand Chazal, but at least they have the knowledge of where wisdom comes from, and that is a true fact, right? They have the knowledge that these people have the wisdom. They're attached to this group, so they're closer to the truth. Now, if you could show them, right, and the raya is, if you'd be able to show them, 1 second, let's look at Chazal, I'll show you really what they mean, they'd accept it in a second. Right, they'd see, yeah, you're right. Right?
Why are they necessarily closer to the truth? Just because they recognize the source?
Yeah, because they have one true idea, and that is that these people are Chacham. Now, they may not know the knowledge that the Chachamim are conveying, but they have that knowledge that this is the area where knowledge lies. That's an important thing.
I thought you were saying they're closer because last week, because it's really not because they're closer, but because the...
Yeah, they're further away.
Yeah, they're further away.
That's right.
The premise of knowledge is that you know nothing.
That's right. So that's one factor, right? That's one idea, which is a true idea. That's one factor, that the way that the person's mita prevents him from gaining knowledge, whereas their mita does not prevent them. Right? That's on one level. But a second level also, they're closer. They're closer in a practical way too. Because they have a piece of knowledge, which is knowledge. The only thing is, they don't have the primary knowledge, but they have a piece of knowledge. The other guys have no knowledge. The only thing is, what we were saying last week is, they're further away not only because they lack knowledge, but because there's something in them that prevents them from getting knowledge. Right? So on two levels, the group is worse. And that's why the Rambam calls them Arur. They're cursed. They're cursed. You know what I mean? Not only do they lack knowledge, but they lack the capacity to gain the knowledge. It's impossible for them to gain the knowledge. Because there's something internally stopping them, and they don't even know where the knowledge lies. So, yeah.
So the group that rejects Chazal, we're not talking about people who see that they're saying things that sound impossible, and they reject them on that basis. We're talking about people who just have a blatant rejection of them.
Now, we're talking about people that see what they're saying is contradictory, but conclude from that they must be foolish people.
Isn't that in some senses closer to truth than the first group, because they're seeing the correct way to evaluate knowledge, that if something doesn't make sense, then they reject it.
That's
they're
right.
But they're just making an extra jump, saying that therefore this is not a source of knowledge.
That's right.
It seems like they have a...
But why are they making the extra jump? That's the question. That's what we talked about last week. Why do they make that extra jump? They see that there's something contradictory here, and therefore they say the authors are fools. 1 second. Is that jump justified? So you'll tell me, okay, they made a mistake there. But we're saying, no, that jump... It stems from a strong motive, which is preventing the person from saying the truth. Because that jump is, basically, I am a pseudo-intellectual. Anybody else who doesn't agree with me has no knowledge. And basically, what these people do is, they look in an area superficially, and if they find contradictions, it's not the search for truth. But the contradiction is something that justifies their feeling of superiority. That's why they immediately degrade Chazal. They say, these guys are nothing. These guys are fools. And why would a person do that? I mean, you take one statement of a person and make him into a fool, well, look at the rest of what he wrote. I mean, you look at the rest of Shas, how can you conclude this person is a fool? It's ridiculous. The person has a whole people in a group has a whole scientific system of halacha. They're fools because of this one contradiction. So obviously, the person is, you know, has this attitude, and this is a justification for the attitude, and therefore he feels justified in just dismissing the whole group. So now we're saying that group is an arrogant group. And the arrogance, that's his point. I mean, whatever you're going to say about particular people, you know, there could be a person that is not really degrading. He's not going into the particulars. He's saying there is a tendency in man, and any person that partakes of that tendency is excluded from knowledge. Okay? So I'm sure, you know, if you think about the people you know, you'll see there are people that you could identify that belong to one of these two groups. You know, and you could imagine who it would be, you know, who would be more likely to be amenable to knowledge. Okay? Good. Right? So that's the thing. Okay. So now we come to the Kachlishis. Okay? Yeah. So the Kachlishis, Ram says, Vahim Chai Hashem Me'atimod. They're very small. Ad she'efshar likro lehem kat, to the point that it is possible to call them a group. K'mo she'efshar lomar al Hashem Shemin. In the same way you call them a group, you could call the sun a category. I mean, what he's saying, right? What he's saying is, the group usually implies a lot of individuals. But here the group is so small that it's questionable whether you can even call it a group. It's really yechidim. It's individuals. All right? Nice mashal. Okay. So yeah. Sorry. He's saying. Yeah. Okay, v'heim ha'anashim. These are the people shenizbara etzlam gedulas ha'chachamim. That is clear to them the greatness of the chachamim. V'tov tvunasam and the goodness of their knowledge. B'ma shenimtza b'chlal divrehem. What they find in their words. Dvarim hamarim alinyanim amtiyim me'od. Words, things that express. True concepts, true subjects. Ve'afal pi shehem me'atim u'mefuzarim b'kamam komos b'chiburehem harehem marim al shalmusam v'hasagasam esayemas. I think what he means is afal pi shehem me'atim. I think heim refers to the ideas that this group sees. In other words, they may not be able to uncover the words of Chazal, show every chachma in every words of Chazal. Like many of the words are beyond us, are deep, and we can't, we're not able to decipher. But even though the things that we could decipher are ma'atim or few umfuzar mekamim kamos and spread out in different areas, b'chiburehem in their works, hari hey marim al shalmusam. They express the shlemus of the authors v'hasagasam esayemus and their comprehension of the truth. So I'm not sure if he means that we're limited in how many things we can decipher of Chazal, or if Chazal didn't write everything they knew. In other words, they had a vast array of knowledge, and they wrote in the Agarata, in the drashos, they wrote different ramazim about different highlights of different areas, but they didn't just write, a treatise just putting forth everything they know. They didn't do that. They wrote very sparsely, and you know, and but from what we see, what we do have, we see the great chacham. Okay. And now I say this: V'gam nisbarer etzlam minias hanimnaos umetzios mechuyav hametzios. Okay, so this is right. You see what the Ram says? He said it's nisbarer etzlam. It is clear to them, to this kat, minias hanimnaos. Minias hanimnaos means the impossibility, the non-existence of the impossible. Okay, umetzius mechuyav hametzius, and the existence of that which is necessary. This is a key thing. This is a key thing in the Rambam. Right? This is a key thing that a person of knowledge. This is how he's describing a person of knowledge. What is a knowledgeable person? A knowledgeable person is a person that knows two things: knows the impossible and knows the necessary. Those are the two things that are prerequisite. They're not prerequisite, but they constitute knowledge. If you say a person has knowledge in an area, that means what he knows is the what is impossible and what must be. If he's lacking knowledge of either of those, he can't say he has knowledge of an area. Whereas if you pick a guy, a physicist, and he won't be able to tell you what's impossible and what must be in physics, then he can't have knowledge of physics. And he's a person who says, it could be, it could be not. He doesn't know. The only way you know an area is if you know what is impossible and what has to be. And actually, the third category, which Ram doesn't mention, is what's possible. But what's possible is whatever is not in the other two groups. In other words, you know what's impossible and you know what has to be. And whatever is neither of those is possible. It's possible. But the knowledge of those three inyanim, those three things, is what knowledge is. There's no knowledge aside from that. So that's what the Rambam says, that these are the people with knowledge, the people that know what's impossible. You know, there are people that think that everything's possible. I mean, they don't recognize the idea that there are things that are absolutely impossible. It just cannot exist. Impossible. Okay? But that's a chacham. That's why if you take a look, it's interesting, because he said in the Kat Rishona, he said there are those people in the Kat Rishona, they are the people that make things that are impossible into necessary. See, so that's what he's saying. That's the height of ignorance, where a person takes something that's impossible and makes it and says it must exist. Okay. So that's an important thing to remember, because a lot of times you're discussing things with people. A lot of source of confusion is because a person, especially in philosophy, a lot of philosophic errors are made because a person is confusing the impossible with the possible or the necessary. A lot of problems, especially in, you know, questions, like people have questions on God, how can God do this? You know, events that happen, they question the existence of God. It's all, usually those questions are based on a misevaluation of what's the impossible. Because if you say that there are certain things that are impossible, then you can't, then these questions disappear. Okay, if there's certain things that in existence that cannot be otherwise, so the questions disappear. What you're asking is, why can't God do the impossible? Okay? I mean, you have to see each argument in general, but I'm saying a lot of times philosophic mistakes are made because a person does not recognize that there is a category of things that are impossible, and if you're asking a question on that category, it's no kasha. Alright? So one time this person my son asked me, Yoni asked me, you know, there was this friend of his who was very disturbed about different things that happened, and he was questioning God. So he says, you know, what should I, you know, what can I say to him? I mean, you know, these are real things, tragedies, and, you know, it seems like, you know, how do you answer a guy like that? It's sort of a justifiable position, you know? So I told him, you have to tell the guy that that there are three categories of things. You should explain these three categories to him and explain to him that there are certain things that are absolutely impossible. So he gave him an example, like a square circle. It's a logical impossibility, right? So, therefore, there are certain things that you may look at as belonging to the possible, but they may belong to the impossible. So, therefore, when you're asking on God, how could he do this, you're asking a question about the impossible. And therefore, it's no kasha. It's like saying, why couldn't God make a square circle? He's a bad God. He can't make a square circle, right? That question would make no logical sense. So you have to explain to him that certain things that you are asking may belong to that category, and see what he's.
Like what would be?
Let's say you say, like, how could these great tragedies happen? An earthquake, where 50,000 people die. I mean, how could God allow this to happen? Right?
It's not impossible.
Ah, so the thing is like this. You evaluate impossible based on your knowledge. Like, let's say, for instance, a person has no knowledge of physics. Right? He'll say, well, why can't a thing go at the speed of light? That's not impossible. Right? But if now if a person studies physics and studies relativity, he says, no, that's an absolute impossibility for any physical object to duplicate the speed of light. It's an absolute impossibility. Right? So things that a person thinks are possible, he could think that because he's lacking knowledge of an area. But once you give him that knowledge, you go, oh, you're right, it's impossible. You see? Oh. So therefore, any question that a person has in an area has to be based on that. The question has to be that you're assuming it's within the realm of possibility. Right? Now, if that's not true, then it's no kasha. In other words, if it could be shown that that earthquake, not to happen, would be an absolute impossibility, it would be like a square circle, then you have no kasha. You see? Ah. Right? The only thing is, we don't understand it because we don't see the underlying laws of nature. So to us, it looks possible. You just don't have an earthquake. Just have a thing go, it's going 10 miles an hour less than the speed of light. Just add 10. That can't happen. You know what I mean? So the thing is, that idea itself makes an impression on a person. In other words, even though you don't know why it's impossible, and it looks to you as personally perfectly possible, it makes a powerful impression. So when he told him this, I didn't know whether it would have an effect, but he said he felt much better. Like, he saw that, you know, he put in logical categories, and then you see, yeah, you're right. It may be no kasha at all. It takes the force of the whole question away. Because behind the question is, you feel justified because it's logical. But the moment you have this framework, it takes the whole force of the question away. Then it's okay, maybe it's a question, we don't know. But you go into an area you have no knowledge about, so the guy feels, you're right. Yeah.
Wouldn't that be a guy who thinks that the impossible is the possible?
Say that again?
Wouldn't it be, instead of the guy with the earthquake, he says that he thinks that things that are, which one was it again?
He's mistaking the impossible for the possible, or the necessary.
Oh, okay. Fine, sorry.
So you're just showing that there's no knowledge in the area, and that it could be impossible? Isn't that like you're saying, like, it could be, like...
Yeah. But the point is like this. The question that the guy has is based on a conviction that there's no reason why an earthquake can't happen. There's no reason why you have to have this earthquake. It's based on that conviction. You know what I mean? And underlying that conviction is that anything's possible. Anything's possible. God could do anything. That's the underlying, that's really the underlying premise that the person has in the back of his mind. That God could just, why can't God just not do it? You know what I mean? But when you show the guy no, you see, once you have knowledge of an area, you know that certain things are impossible, can't possibly exist, it's like a square circle, it takes away the force of the question. Then he senses, you're right, there's no basis for this. And the whole force of the question is gone.
Why is it impossible to stop an earthquake?
Well, we don't, that's what I'm saying. In other words, what I'm saying is, if a person has knowledge of an area, he could know that a thing that looks perfectly possible is absolutely impossible, like squaring a circle. Now, we don't have knowledge of that area, but I'm saying the conviction is based on the fact, when you say, hey, why can't I just have this earthquake? Why could I not have it? I could have it or not have it. It's, either way, it's possible. That's the same thing as saying, why can't a body go at the speed of light? Yeah, it looks possible, but once you study the laws of physics, you'll see that's an absolute impossibility. It's like having a square circle. So I'm saying the same thing over here. The question is no basis. It's just a question based on no knowledge whatsoever and saying, why can't that be? Well, it could be if it belongs to that category, but if it belongs to the category of the impossible, then it certainly can't be. You know what I mean? I'm not answering the question. I'm just saying the question has no basis. You're pulling the rug from under the person. Yeah.
Well, so we're not saying that it's impossible to stop an earthquake. We're just saying that for whatever happened, it was because it had to happen. Had to happen.
Right.
Is that what you're saying?
That's right. Now, if that event belongs to the necessary, to something that must occur of necessity, and the non-occurrence of it would belong to the category of the impossible, then you'd see you have no kasha. You know what I'm saying?
Who says it belongs to
I'm not saying it does. I'm not saying it does. I'm just, in other words, the only thing I'm saying is that the question, the force of the question is based on certain underlying premises. You know what I mean? I'm just saying those premises, you have to know your premises. Once the person knows his premises, he sees, oh, you're right, that question is based on this thing. Now I have no knowledge about that, so what's my question? It's like saying, a guy have a question on a bodily function. And why the cell, why does the cell do this? It's crazy. I mean, I wouldn't think of asking that. I don't know anything about the cell or the cell operation. I'm just using my imagination to imagine that a cell should do X, Y, Z. It's crazy. Why isn't it possible that the cell should do this? Why isn't it possible a guy has diabetes? Why is that impossible that he shouldn't be able to process sugar? Why should he have high blood sugar? It doesn't make any sense. I mean, a person wouldn't ask that because he knows that there are parameters and impossibilities, and the question is based on nothing. It doesn't mean to say that he's wrong, but the question's no question.
Were you saying that the group who accepts everything, they don't recognize the category of the impossible?
That's right.
That seems to me like a much bigger knowledge flaw than the other group. If there are three categories of knowledge and these people just don't recognize one at all, whereas it seems like the other people recognize that category, they just have a... this problem of related knowledge through their
arrogance. Right, but it's not a much bigger flaw, because the thing is that the reason why it's not a much bigger flaw is because the other group is a greater flaw. You know what I mean? It's a greater flaw, because the thing of knowledge is not how many things you know. You know what I mean? It's how you know it. It's not how many things you know. A guy can know a lot of things and be very far from the truth, because it's how he knows it. You know what I mean? A guy can know less things, but know it in a way that he's closer to the truth. You know what I mean? So a guy can have a lot of knowledge and be an arrogant guy and not want to listen to anything, and that's it. He won't progress anywhere. You know what I mean? A guy can have a little knowledge, but he's on the right track. He's much better off than the other guy. Okay?
I don't understand how he can be on the right track if he doesn't recognize that there's such a thing as something impossible.
Because that's a particular. That is a particular. In other words, take a kid that's 7 years old, ask him, are the things that are impossible, without explaining anything. So no. Then you start to show him, 1 second, square circle, is that impossible? Then you can teach him. And then he'll see, oh, yeah, you're right. Right? Now, the second before you told him that, is he so far from the truth? No. He's waiting to hear the truth. You know what I mean? He doesn't have it. But that's a particular. He may not have this piece of information. That doesn't mean he's far from the truth. He's waiting. Once you demonstrate to him, that's it. He's got it. You know what I mean? But there could be a person who has distorted thinking that you're going to show him arguments, and he's a combative person. He's not going to hear it. Well, he may know that certain things are impossible, but that's about as much as he's going to know. So what good is that? He's a combative person. You try to explain him anything further. That's it. No, this. You know, bring in 500 arguments. He's not equipped to handle the truth. You know what I mean? So he may know a lot of particular facts. Fine, but that's not going to help him in pursuit of knowledge. Right? Okay. Okay, so you see this. The Yadu, so they know, this group, right? Shehem Aleim Hashom Lo Dibro Divrei Havai. They know that these people do not speak just empty words. Okay, v'nisparah etzlam, and it's clear to them sheyesh b'dvreihem that there are in the words of Chazal pshat v'sod. There is the plain meaning, and there's the secrets. There's the underlying meaning. Okay, they know that. Okay, now he says like this: shekol mashama midvarim. Anything that Chazal say from things shehem bilti afsharim that are impossible, ein dvareihem b'kach. So therefore they understand that anything the Chazal say that belong to the category of the impossible must be a mashal. That's clear. As once a person has the category of the impossible and the possible, so he knows. The Chazal are the source of knowledge. Now they've said a statement which we're going to assume is true. If it's something that belongs to the category of the impossible, it is impossible. That's what they meant. Right? So therefore it must be a mashal. So, yeah.
It's possible that they didn't have, like they said, they didn't have knowledge in a certain area, so they didn't know it was impossible. So therefore,
that's possible. That is possible. But That's not something you would assume. You wouldn't
he's
assume
talking
that.
Talking about logical impossibilities, not like impossible because you had the wrong facts. Like a square circle is like just a logical impossibility.
Right. If they did not know that.
Right, so that they cannot know. In other words, you're right. In other words, a logical impossibility, right, that's something that does not require information. It's something that's categorized in the mind. In other words, if they would say there's a square circle, so you'd know that the person can't, this belongs to the impossible.
I'm talking about the speed of light.
Okay, right. So you're saying, well, your question is, let's say they're speaking of a subject that we know because of certain knowledge that they didn't have access to, right, that we know that is impossible. But they didn't have access to that knowledge, right? They didn't know relativity. You're right. So then in that area, you could say that they didn't know. They didn't know it's impossible. That's for sure. But what he's saying is that the area that Chazal is talking about is an area that's knowledgeable about, right? They're knowledgeable about common phenomena, right? Like that, day and night, I mean, whatever it is. That's the type of, what he's saying is, you're correct. In other words, that he's talking about when you read Chazal, the phenomena that they're talking about are blatant contradictions. Okay? So that's an impossibility. Okay? So therefore, they know it must be Mashal. V'kachu derech ha-chachamim ha-gadon. And this is the derech of the Chachamim Gadon. So this is an interesting thing. In other words, you can get carried away with this. You could say, listen, this is a Chazal, it's a metaphorical. He doesn't say that. You see, he says that anything that's impossible, right? He says, Shekol ma she'amar mi devrehim, shehem bilti efshariyim. He doesn't say, Shekol ma she'amru. Everything they say in Agadatos or Midrashim is metaphorical. He doesn't say that. He says, how do you know? You have a barometer. If you see that it's impossible, you know, it must be mashal. But if it does not belong to that category, then it may not be a mashal. You see, so you could get carried away. You could say, any thing I don't understand, it's a mashal, or anything that conflicts with my philosophy, it's a mashal, they didn't really mean it. That's not what the Rambam's saying. You can't use that as a tool. No, there's an objective criterion. If you could show me it's an impossibility, what they're saying is contradictory, then it's a mashal. But otherwise, you don't necessarily have a right to say that, no, they meant that metaphorically. You know what I mean? It's not just a free-for-all. Anything they say in Nagarta is a metaphor. Right? So he's following, he's following his premises, logical premises. Since there are impossibilities and possibilities and necessities, and therefore Chazal are rational people, they cannot say something that belongs to the category of the impossible, and therefore it must be metaphor. He's not just throwing it out. Well, we know they speak metaphors. No, he's giving a real logical system. Yeah.
There's stories about like seven-headed dragon, right?
Right.
Are those do we interpret them differently because they're impossibilities? Because it's not impossible.
Impossibility. It must be an impossibility.
It's not impossible.
Well, we got to see. We got to analyze each one. But if it doesn't involve the impossible, so then he's saying that it's not. Then he's saying it's not necessarily metaphorical. In other words, what's metaphorical is what forces us to say it's metaphorical is because it's an impossibility. Now you have to analyze each one and see. You have to analyze each one and see what it belongs to the impossible. But if it does not belong to the impossible, so then that's it.
What about something like that where it's not necessarily an impossibility, you just learn more if you take it as a metaphor?
You have to see the measures. I'm just saying, going according to his thing, right? This is what he says: Shekol ma she'amar midvarim shehem bilti efshariyim. That is not possible, right? Ein devarim b'kach ela al derech chidum ha'mashal. That is the barometer. So therefore, if I was studying a measure, the analysis would be what belongs to the possible, what belongs to the impossible. If there's something that's impossible, then you know it's metaphorical. Doesn't mean every single detail in the measure has to be impossible. That would be crazy. But it means to say that if you look at the measures, you will see something in there that is contradictory. It is not possible to be taken literally. Not possible. Okay? And if you don't see that, if the thing could be read perfectly logically, shoot the kamashmal, so I don't see you have a right to interpret it. There has to be some kind of impossibility. And I'm just saying, based on what he's saying. So you have to, we could look at Midrashim, but That's it. Okay? Okay. That's the barometer. If you go beyond that, then apparently, you know, you're out on thin ice. You know, you're not necessarily interpreting the Chachamim, you may be interpreting yourself. Okay, but if you want to be interpreting, if you want to be getting the true meaning of what they're saying, then apparently you have to follow this is the barometer. This is the standard. This is the parameters. Okay? The Kachu Derech Chachamim Magdon. This is the Derech. The Fichach, Pasach, Sifro, Gadol HaChachamim, Va'amru, Lahavin Mashal, Umelitza, Divrei Chachamim V'chidosam. Therefore, that's why Shlomo Melech introduced his Sefer by saying, Lahavin Mashal Umelitza, Divrei Chachamim V'chidosam. So that's Mishle. Okay? Then he introduced it by saying to understand the mashalim of the Chachamim. So apparently Chachamim speak in mashalim. Otherwise that statement would not have too much meaning. Right? So Chachamim speak in the language of mashalim. They mask their words. Okay? So he's bringing support. In other words, it's logical. Illogically you must say that these are mashalim because they involve impossibilities. Okay, but not only logically, if you want to show from the text itself, from the firsthand, read Mishle. Okay, Shlomo says it openly. Ukvar yadua eitzel chachmei alashon ki chida heim advarim shein yonim besodam velo bepashtam. And it's known that chida, riddle, means that the meaning is in the hidden meaning. It's not the pshat. The pshat leads you when you give a riddle, right? The riddle, the surface statement is to lead you to something deep, some idea. Okay. Kamo shamar chuda na lachem chida lefi shedivrei kol balei hachachma bedvar manes gavim shehem atachlis einam ela b'derech chida mashal, because the method of the chachamim is that with an area which is deep, which is very abstruse, the method is to give it over in a hidden way. Okay? Umadu nispale al shechavru esachachma, chibur esachachma bederech mashal. Why should a person be shocked that they composed chachma in this way? V'dimu osam bedvarm shfelim. And they look at it like a low thing. Like if you're going to say, this is a mashal, yeah, all these things are mashalim, all these agadotas are mashalim, they look at that like a low thing, like you're downgrading it. Okay? V'hinach roa ha-chacham mikol adam asakein baruch ha-kodesh. Kolom ha-shlomo v'mishle. You see that the chacham mikol adam did, by baruch ha-kodesh, he did this. B'shir ha-shirim mixas koelas. And many of these works are metaphorical. Okay, they're not literal. Umadu yehi muzar beinenu. Why should it be strange? Lefarish es dvrem lehotziam mipashtam. Why should it be strange to interpret the words and take them out from the plain pshat? Kedei shehi toam as a muskal, so that it should be appropriate for ideas. Umatim leemes lekisvei hakodesh. Right? In other words, he's what do you call it? Commenting, or he's trying to show that there is a tendency against this. People do not want to look at it metaphorically. They want to look at it literally. Like they consider it some kind of defect to say, oh, there's another meaning. It's you have to interpret it. They consider it like a defect, like a low thing for some reason. Right? He's pointing that out. And that's not based on reality. That's some kind of tendency in man to consider that a defect. I don't know why, but right? Parihim atzma mevarim. But you see, the fact is, all he's saying is that even though there is a tendency to look at that like some kind of cop out, I don't know exactly, but I guess that he's trying to identify what the tendency, why people are fixed to doing it, to not interpreting, to just accepting the plain pshat. Right? But he's saying the fact is that it's impossible to deny this. Okay? V'harihem atzma mevarim psukei ksuvim u'motziim osam mipshutam v'osim osam mashal v'ames. They themselves take psukim and interpret them. Right? Kafisha Matsanu Shaamru Shazesh Amar Kasav Hu Hakeh Shnei Ariel Moav. I don't know. I mean, we could go through the Pesukim, but he's bringing these sources. I'm not familiar with these sources, but he's saying that these sources, Chazal themselves, took the Pesukim and they interpreted them metaphorically. They took them out of the Pshat and they said they're not literal. Okay, Kulo Mashal. The Chazal said that this area found in Divrei Yamim is Kulo Mashal, it's a total Mashal. V'chein Mash Nemar. All of these cases, brought that in the Gemara, right? Chazal say mashal, that it is not literal. V'chein say for Eov kulo, Omar echa mehem mashal haya. One of Chazal said that Sefer Eov was a total mashal. Never happened. It was not an actual historical fact. It's a mashal. It's a total mashal. V'lo biyav leze inyan, na'ase ha-mashal hazeh. And they didn't explain what the mashal was. But Eov, one of Chazal said, it's total mashal. So how could you say that Chazal don't speak of mashalim? It's an impossibility. V'chein meisei Yechezkel amar echa mehem mashal hayav. V'rav m'kelev, many cases like this. Where Chazal themselves took Tanakh, or Nach, and said that it's metaphorical. So you see that is a method. Now if that's a method, it would be very hard to assume the Chazal doesn't follow that method. Right? They say that the mass method of the Torah, but they would follow it themselves. I mean, there's no reason to say that they would say we cannot have, you know, everything must be literal when they themselves say that all these pesukim are mashalim. Okay. So that's the thing, right? So as we say, so he's saying you see factually, you cannot deny it, and in terms of ideas, it doesn't make sense to deny it. It'd be impossible for a thinking person to deny it. Okay, yeah.
It seems weird that he's saying mashal is a very good tool for transmitting hapa, whatever the mashal may be. But we should only take as a mashal the that which be would be impossible if we didn't take it as a mashal.
That's right.
I don't understand if mashal is a good tool, then shouldn't we just transmit everything or interpret anything that we see great ideas in if we interpret it metaphorically? Shouldn't we just interpret that metaphorically?
Right, because the problem is, how do you know it's a mashal?
Well, if we can see that there's a great idea behind it, then it seems more likely that they're just using mashal to give a great idea for it. I mean,
the problem is giving you the parameter for knowing something's a mashal. In other words, everything that operates, right, it has to be logical. You can't just have a system where everything's just give things and let people decide what it is. You know, it has to be based on some kind of system. So there's a system here, right? And the Rambam is telling you what the system is. That something is a mashal. It has to be based on knowledge. You can't just say, well, I think it's a mashal because there's a great idea behind there. I mean, you could take things in Shas and, you know, say, there were groups that took Shor Shanagach and said it's a mashal, you know? So you can't just take things and say, I see a great idea here, this is a mashal. I mean, you know, thought has to be based on fixed... It has to be causality. There has to be strict causality. So therefore, the Rambam's giving you, saying, there's factors here. What are the factors? If it's impossible, it must be mashal. If it's not impossible, so there may be a deep idea behind there. Very good. So it may be on two levels, you see. It may be that they're writing something that makes sense on its surface, but there's a remez there to show you a deeper idea. That could be. But mashal is different. Mashal means that the whole thing is to show you a deep idea. That, you know, you can't just make that up. It has to be based on the parameters. So he's giving you the guidelines. Everything has to have guidelines. That's the guideline. It's impossible, then it's a mashal. Not impossible? Okay, then you're on your own. Yeah.
Is he saying that if it's not impossible, that it cannot be a mashal rechida, or that it's not necessarily?
I mean, that's a good question. I mean, he's saying that...
Tell me if it's impossible. It definitely is.
It would seem. I mean, on the surface, I would say at this point, I mean, without any, you know, maybe we could do further analysis, you know, if we have more information. But based on the information he's giving us so far, right, it would seem that for the guideline is it's impossible. Therefore, it's a mashal. If that's not impossible, then it's not a mashal. I mean, that's how I say on the surface. Now, it could be that there are other factors that go into it that he hasn't introduced to us. So then we'll have to revise it. But at this point, if you want to operate logically, right, he's giving you a guideline. That means it has to be a guideline. I mean, if it's not, if mashal is the possible and the impossible, then what kind of guideline is that? You know, then you have to give me another guideline. But the guideline he's given is the impossible. So then we have to stick with that. So that means the possible is not a mashal. Now, it doesn't mean it, there's no other idea there, but it just, a mashal is different. A mashal means, see, you could have a pasuk in the Torah that tells you a plain pshat, and the plain pshat is true. But the way the pasuk was written is, will lead you into a deeper idea. That doesn't mean it's a mashal. You know what I mean? That means that there are many ideas there that the pasuk is relating. That's not a mashal. That's not what it means by mashal. You see, so if you show me a thing the Chazal said that's true on the surface, but it has a deeper idea, that could be. You're not denying that. But he's just saying there's a category of thing called mashal, and this is how you know it. Yeah. All right? Okay. So we'll see you Monday? Yeah. Is this off? Oh, no.
He kept saying, here, what's the phrase? I didn't have a chance to look at any Rishonim, but it just struck me as... where is it? The seven sins for the seven punishments, something like that, where is it?
Rashi brings that down.
Who?
What is it?
Rashi.
Sheva. Yeah. Achat Hasechem.
Right.
He lists them. I gave Shira years ago.
Okay.
Harei Sheva.
Says it five times.
Hey, but who comes there? I'm sorry, excuse me. Here it is. Vahakachem et briti kofer v'ika. Harei Sheva v'erok. Harei Shona v'oreret ha-shmiya. V'chein ha-shmiya. V'eilu hein. Rashi, is that what you're asking about?
Yeah.
Okay. So the way Rashi learns, you know, there's a deeper meaning. It's when it talks about the aspects, the most additional meaning. It's both ways. So, for example, like in Mechukos, I say, Lechu, what does that mean? In Mechukos, I say, Lechu, we have to talk about Kishru, about Kishru, about Kishru, about Kishru. Each one has a specific meaning. And the first one is, Elam Bator. The seven are, okay, and then you have the negative. Then you have the, amelum, but let me just, okay. First one is, I'm going from the negative now. Well, Lamad, corresponding to Amel and Batoro. Below Asa, the second one is to do the Mitzvot. Okay, the third one is, as a result of, now, if you have a success on Moed, Bacherim, so it begins to despise the others who do the Mitzvot. Then you have Sonia Shabakan. Shabakan. Then you have Monea Zafir. Then you have the prevent other people from doing this work. Then you have Kofra Bermitzvah. That he abandons the Mitzvah, he denies the Mitzvah. Then you have Kofra Bidika, he denies God. So that's Lahafra Hamas Barisi. That, these are the seven steps. And once you reach that point, that is to say that God doesn't just punish. Divine punishment for a particular avera, so on and so forth. But then, this parsha, these types of punishments talking about in this parsha, is brought about when you have the phenomenon of Hafara's bris. That's what the Pasuk says. The Imuchu Kosai Tismo, Timotar, Timotu. You have two Sukkim over there. The Imuchu Tishmuli. But it makes sense. I was talking about Parshas Imuchu Kosai, which contains the Bachos and the Kolos. And before the Kolos are introduced, it's the Torah depicts the causes. The causes are brought down. Basically, the averos. But according to Rashi, there are seven specific steps. One step leads to the next. And it concludes with Lahafrachem and Barisi. So, it's important to study these two psukim very carefully, because it's not just saying that you didn't... Because you wonder, what is it that the Jews have done that brings about such a severe klala? Such severe punishment. You have to understand, no people is perfect. Nobody's perfect, no individual is perfect. And certainly, you're talking about a nation, it's a completely different thing. You have different parts to a nation. No nation is perfect, and you will have sinners amongst them. So those are issues. At what point in time does it become the sin of the entire nation and responsibility and so forth? But what kind of sins are we talking about? So this is very, very important because it's something which is very specific. And it helps us to understand the big problem in that, generally speaking, it's difficult for people to understand the harshness. The harshness of the decrees over here. But if you look at the pasuk, you'll see that we're not just talking about an avera or two, we're talking about a process which I guess you could express it as the Jewish people actually nullifying the bris, nullification of the bris. But that's what it concludes with. But it's the end of a long process which begins with the abandonment of Amelam B'Torah, and that seems to be the axis. Everything revolves around that. But that's the first. It would seem, as long as that's intact, then the other things will not happen. But then there's a certain element of inevitability. It seems to be the case that one thing leads to another. It seems to be sort of inevitable. So there's certainly a cause and effect relationship. And goes from there to the abandonment of the mitzvot. And it doesn't stop at that. It's interesting. Why doesn't it just stop at that? It does not. Then it proceeds to the attitude towards other people who keep the mitzvot, Moed. And then from there it goes to the hatred of the chachamim. And then it becomes active in preventing people from doing mitzvot. And eventually it leads to the kfir of the mitzvot. And ultimately the kfir of Hashem, which is the hafrachamim breezy. And that, that's a state of absolute untenable, that situation. The Jewish people pretty much has given up its Jewishness, has given up its identity, and that's when these factors come into play. Alright, now what's your question? What's your question, Dan? Hello?
Yeah.
What's your question?
Just how they all relate. I mean, I'd say they relate like in order, but...
Well,
you think,
I would just do a little bit of it. I don't know if I'll do it. ago. This is an oldie. I have a tape on this in the Yeshiva library. I gave a shear, but let's say we could, you know, I haven't done it in a very long time. So let's just start from scratch here. Let me hear from you guys. Which part of it is difficult, or which part of it doesn't make sense, or which part does make sense? Let's just let's do a beginning over here. If you look at it the other way, actually, you see, the blessings and curses revolve around these things. Mechukos HaKei Lechu. Yes, it's supposed to be the Shmoru. Vatisem Osam. Well, those are three things. Mechukos HaKei Lechu. Let's do the first few Rashis. First few Rashis in Mechukos HaKei Lechu. I would think that you first be key on mitzvah. Because that's the way it does appear at first land. To walk in my statutes, the statutes seem to be a reference to the mitzvot, and it's telling us that we have to keep them. But Rashi says it's not. If you're home there, we have to suppose I teach Moru, because the very next thing says, and observe my mitzvot, keep my mitzvot. So that's talking about kiyum ha-mitzvot. I read kiyum ha-mitzvot omor. And then it would be redundant. It's not going to be redundant. Omor ani mekayim im b'chukos ha-tei lechu. So then how do I understand im b'chukos ha-tei lechu? To see you ha-meilim b'torah. To see ha-meilim b'torah. What does that mean to be ha-meilim b'torah? Interesting. It's an interesting expression. The term amola. That's a very famous yeshivish term, amola and yigia, which implies more than just studying. But to be amel, to be amel, means to really labor, strenuous laboring in Torah, as opposed to just using the term learn. So that's what Rashi's saying over here. It's not just saying that you're learning Torah, you're engaging in Talmud Torah, but you're amel in the Torah. It's, again, it implies someone who's really working laboriously. Then it says the mitzvotai tishmeru. So Rashi says havu amelu b'torah al manas lishmar. We're saying that you should be amel in Torah al manas with the condition of guarding and doing. Moshe nemar l'maratam osam u'shmartam l'asosam. You shall study them and guard them to do them. What's the point of Rashi? What's he making over here? Yeah, two things. Conditions for the brachos are based upon two things, study and asiyah. But Rashi has given it a certain modification. The study part has been, it's not just simply study, there's the emphasis of amelim. And the doing part is not just something you do, but now he's saying that this modifies the study part as well. That you should be amel for the sake of doing. So what's the idea over here? And also, are there any questions? Any questions just on this? So it's interesting for the... All you need is two things for the bracha. Two things. In order to achieve the bracha, all you need basically seems is two things. Amala and mitzvot. And the amala has to be for the sake of keeping the mitzvot.
But aren't these the two highest levels? I mean, wouldn't they come after all the other ones?
You mean?
Meaning, if those are the first things to go in terms of the Averas, then in terms of the mitzvos, it should work in the opposite order. I mean, the first thing would be that you would believe in God, and then you'd believe in the mitzvos, and the last thing would be Amelam the Torah.
You mean what comes first?
Yeah.
He's not talking about that. Rav Rashi's not talking about what comes first. In the order of things. Well, obviously, you're 100% correct. Obviously, if a person doesn't believe in God, he doesn't believe in the Torah, so he's not going to be a male in God. But, it's the point. Rashi here is not mentioning the prior step. That is, Rashi doesn't talk about, when it mentions the blessings, it doesn't talk about if you'll believe in God, and if you'll believe in the Torah, and if you will revere the Torah scholars. It doesn't go that way. But rather, it picks it up at this point. those things, of course, are presumed. But why aren't they mentioned? That's a good question as to why they're not mentioned, but you have to say that those things are presumed. Because it's impossible for a person not to be able to Torah if he doesn't believe in God, if he doesn't believe in Torah, and so forth. So these things, it takes it up already where those foundations are there. Okay, well why? Why, yeah, I mean, I hear your question. It would seem that those prior steps are obviously are important and they're connected, but they're not enough to engender the bracha. We're talking here particularly about the bracha, and in order to engender, if you don't have these two factors, we're not saying, you see, you might ask this question, if these are the factors which will bring about the bracha, so then their absence, you would think, so it ought to bring about the opposite. And why do you have to go on to all the other steps? That's a good question. What would you say to that?
Well, this is a great...
It's symmetric. In other words, I'm saying is that it's not symmetric.
There's a grace period.
It's presenting the positives. These are the positives. These positives will bring about the bracha. Then it would seem that this, then if you don't, on the other hand, if you don't have these positives, you'll get the presence. But it's not the case, because it doesn't stop at the absence of the first two. It keeps going in order to bring about the clause. I hope you understand what I'm talking about. Okay.
So there's a grace period.
What do you mean a grace period?
Meaning you only get the brachas if you do, I guess, everything. And if you're not doing everything, you don't necessarily get the klalas, but if you're doing nothing, then you get the klalas.
Okay, so what's the reason for that? And that's symmetric, right. So what's the reason?
Can you explain what you mean by not symmetric? I'm not sure.
Oh. In other words, it sounds like if you do A, you get the reward. If you don't do A, you'll get the punishment. That's generally what you, how you, you know, deal with people in situations. If you do this, then I'll reward you. If you don't do this, then I'll punish you. That's what it seems to be. But it's not identical, because if you don't do A and B, you're not going to necessarily get the punishment. Rashi then says it's because you'll go to the other five steps.
Okay, I see. Thanks.
Yeah, I think that the idea is that the punishment does not come about simply because of an absence of these two. These two are very, very significant and represent the highest possible level of the Jewish people. And when they achieve this level, then they're worthy of the brachos. So you have a situation where the Jews may not be worthy of these brachos. Indeed, if you take a look at the Ramban, Ramban says that, by the way, that these are brachos that are relate to the entire klal. They're not. They have brachos that relate to each person as an individual, and that's a separate phenomenon. These are not brachos that relate to an individual. That's interesting. You see what I'm saying? In other words, you may have individuals who will live on this level, who will do those things that would bring about the brachos. But it will not, it's not enough, the fact that an individual does it or some individuals do it. That will only pertain to them as individuals. And but you see that this is talking here about a national phenomenon. It's talking about things that can only pertain to the seabird. The amount of the crop, the agriculture, the wealth, two major things seem to be the, we'll make it three, for example, tremendous prosperity. Then you have the factor of peace, but connected to that is the element of victory in war. If you'll be tremendously successful in war, and then there'll be peace, apparently. I mean, whatever. You can you have to reconcile the two, but if there's peace, so why is it telling you that your enemies will run away from you? But whatever. I mean, maybe there's different stages, and that's the means to an end, that you'll become extremely powerful. So there's a military factor, and then you'll achieve a state of a tremendous peace. Obviously, these are things that pertain to the entire tzibur, as Ramban points out. So it's not talking about the individual. The individual is a different story. Okay? Thus, the Ramban says that the blessings, as depicted over here, were never ever achieved in Jewish history. That is consideration That's his understanding. At the time, he lived in the Middle Ages, that looking at the past, there was never a time in Jewish history that the Jews as a nation achieved the type of level that would bring about these kinds of problems. But that'll happen. That'll happen at some future date. Now, we're about 1,000 years later, it doesn't appear that at any point since the Ramban that the Jews achieved this. To the contrary, the history of the last 1,000 years has essentially been persecution. So, but they will happen at a future date. I don't know that this is something which can only happen in Mashiach. It doesn't seem to be the case. This is not necessarily a messianic phenomenon. But this is part of the covenant, part of the grid, that if the Jews achieve this level, on a national level, then these brothers will come into being. Okay? So what's the point? Well, let me ask you another question. You see, now you can understand, though. It would seem then, however, that even though we don't merit, and it would have to be that way, since it's a very exalted state, as Ramban says, that it's never even been achieved, so then you can't say that if we fail to achieve this state, that we're going to be worthy of all of the punishment. That's not the case. Because that would be a hard thing to fathom. You can't subject people. You can't subject people to tremendous punishment, or you know, perhaps to any punishment, simply because they failed to achieve the highest level of perfection. And the Rambam talks about Obey Me'ava, the highest level of service, of divine service. He talks about this in chapter 10 of Hilchos Teshuva. He talks about the different levels of service. You know, Shalom Lishma, Lishma, and then there's Ahama. That's an interesting subject to go into. Actually, I'm taking it up, but one of my themes for sure is nice. He says very clearly that the highest ideal is to serve from Ahava, not for anything in the world, not for any extraneous motivation at all, but purely because of the person's love of the Borei, Ahava Hashem, and desire to do his commandments. But he says that that's a very rare thing. And he says that even great chachamim do not necessarily achieve that level. And then he begins to describe it a bit. And, of course, the paradigm for that is Avraham Avinu. So, you can't say, even though that's the highest ideal, but you can't say that for failing to achieve the highest ideal, a person is going to be subjected to punishment. Doesn't seem to be any punishment whatsoever. Because that's a high level of perfection. God doesn't, the system of punishment, rewards and punishments, I would say that there's reward. There's always reward. And that fits in very beautifully with the Rambam's understanding of Hashkacha. Because the rewards are not as we understand it. That is that you're going to get something because you deserve it. And if you don't deserve it, you won't get it. It doesn't work that simplistically because it's a natural phenomenon. According to the Rambam, it's a natural phenomenon that's quote unquote built into the system that as a person reaches a higher level in terms of his Yetzias Hashem, and he's totally preoccupied with his pursuit of the knowledge of God, so he automatically comes under the divine protection. So the positive is going to be there. But the fact that he may not achieve such an exalted level, which few people achieve, doesn't mean he deserves to be punished. Okay. So what's going on? So what's next? Now, I do you understand why it has to be this way? Thus, the fact that the Jews did not achieve those conditions of Amelim B'Torah and the Shneiras HaMitzvot, learning for the sake of the mitzvot, the fact that they didn't achieve that does not mean that they're deserving of punishment. It's only if they reach a certain level of corruption that the punishments do kick in. The other thing is that Rashi seems to say that the failure to achieve that is like the first step. You know, when you think about it, I mean, it seems to be more serious than that. But it's to say that it then becomes a matter of One go Avera, Gara, Avera. As one sin leads to another, and I mean, if you take it literally, it just seems to be inevitable. It's just because it's a matter of time. But nevertheless, we have to understand that. What are we talking about over here? Inevitability, or just that there's a certain cause and effect relationship. But these punishments are not given merely because they didn't reach that level. That's because Hafara is bris. That's the ultimate situation where the Jews pretty much are giving up the Torah. Because they're no longer the Jewish people, basically. Really, it would seem to me that the idea being that at that point in time they're really chayav kloya, so to speak. That they're really worthy of destruction because they don't have their identity. So there's no basis for their existence. But that's part of the Ashkacha, that God doesn't destroy the Jews. That he puts them in certain situations, of course, of great suffering and distress, but the purpose of all of that will be that they will survive. Ultimately, it's to give them another opportunity. Otherwise, they'd be obliterated. Okay, so now that that's sort of like an overview, what would you like to hone in on? For example, let's take the first two. No one's responding, so I'm just going to...
Yeah. We're here.
Yeah, good.
Can I ask another general question first?
Okay.
What's the purpose of the punishment? Is there like a purpose, or is it just a natural result?
I just said it. Were you listening to me?
Yeah. But
I said that the purpose... No, I don't think it's a natural result. I don't know. I don't think that the punishment here would be the natural result of things. I'm not so sure about that. Doesn't seem to be that way. That is... I don't think that this applies to other nations necessarily. There's nothing looking to the laws of nature that would bring it about that people who reject the gods or whatever will automatically suffer these kinds of consequences. This is part of the Ashkacha, this is part of the Brit, part of the covenant. And as I said, the purpose is, ironically, I mean, it's obviously a terrible punishment, but from a different standpoint, there is some element of it being positive in the sense that were it not for this, there wouldn't be a Jewish people. That is, the Jews have reached such a state where they no longer can be defined as the Am Hashem, as the Mamlachas Kohanim, the Gai Kadosh, on any level whatsoever. There's got to be, there's different levels, but at least the whole as a people, you still are true to the mission. You still keep the Torah and so forth. There's been different levels, different centuries, different times. And how many, we can't judge. We can't judge how many people would, because there's always people, even in good times, that they reject, that are not religious, they give up to Judaism. But we're talking about a significant factor over here, where it becomes pretty much the entire nation. So then, really, they'd be deserving of destruction. But Hashem works it out in such a way that they're forced to repent. And that's all for the sake of the covenant. That's the purpose. That's what I'm saying is the purpose.
Yeah.
Otherwise, in other words, there'd be something worse than this. There is something worse. According to this, there's something worse than the Kalala, and that is complete non-existence.
Right.
Okay. Alright, so now, what do you want to do? Anything specific? That is one thing leads to another, that's one question.
Well, I have a question that in the last one that says deny the existence of God, that doesn't seem like a step. That seems like, well, like kind of how Shai was saying before, it's like a premise of all these things. Like, you would not dedicate yourself to Torah and not do mitzvahs because you deny God. No, it wouldn't be like, I don't see how this would come about. I would see first you deny God, something would happen and you'd say there's no God, and then you'd start denying the things in the opposite order of how Rashi has them.
No, it doesn't work that way. People, no, I can understand it. Questions being raised with regard to the witnessing to make sense that people, obviously, they stopped learning, they stopped doing this one, so that means they've denied God already. Why does Rashi say that the Kafa Vikra is the last step? You have to understand the psychological makeup of the individual. And that is
that it's true. He needs it all. I mean, unconsciously, the person has a problem with the idea of God, and he's seeking to remove himself. That's the underlying problem, that they're seeking to remove themselves from the yoke. This has always been a problem for the Jews. They want to be like a nation like all the other nations. They want to be free in that, in instinctually, the way they understand freedom. Freedom to do as we please. That's always been the struggle, to do as we please. And the truth of the matter is, not even to, when they say to cover Be'ikar, it doesn't necessarily mean that they don't want to have God in their lives, because everybody's doing it. But they want to have God that is in line with their emotional needs, especially as a Hozar. But to sacrifice that and to relate to who Elokeinu knows that there is no other being, and to remodel, to work over your whole nature in accordance with the directives of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the system of mitzvot, which goes contrary to man's desires and illusions and fantasy. Judaism is a unique system. There's no other system, there's no other philosophy of life, whether it be the philosophy of hedonism today. Everything is to gratify your own emotional desires. That's the whole essence of human life. And everybody's pursuing his dreams. And Judaism is a system which causes you to confront all of that and to renounce all of that and redirect your energy towards the Christian concept of the good, which is totally abstract and doesn't appeal to these basic emotions. So that's the tension. But the person doesn't just say, I'm giving up God. It goes, that's not the way a person works. There's many other factors, and if he's not careful, you'll see, he gives up one thing, the resistance manifests itself in certain places. Now, ultimately, what the Rashi is saying is interesting, because you have the Kosei Teleichu, it starts with, V'yetz Mitzvotai Tishmer. They both pretty much seem to be saying the same thing. They both pretty much seem to be saying the idea of keeping the mitzvah. So that's why Rashi says, don't take the Chukotai Teleichu to mean Shmiras and Mitzvah. Even though the words themselves could imply that, but you can't say that because the next one is Mitzvotai Tishmer. So therefore, one of them has to be something different. He says, so one of them is talking about Amel and Torah, and the second one is talking about Mitzvah. So why do you reverse it then? Why don't you say, in the Chukotai Teleichu is referring to the Mitzvah, and Mitzvotai Tishmer is referring to Amel and Torah? You know what I'm saying? You understand what I just said?
Well,
both of these terms could apply to, both of those terms could apply to keeping the mitzvah. If we know that they both can't, because then it would be repetition. So one of them has to apply to something else, which is connected to mitzvah, which is the Amel of the Torah. But how do you know that, which is which? Why do you assume that the Chukotai Teleichu is the first one is Amel of the Torah? That's my question.
Well, the word Teleichu,
has to be studied.
No, Well, when you're intellectually building up your conceptions in regards to God and the Torah, you're progressively going from place to place. You're going up, hopefully. That's where the connotation of Teleichu comes from, I think, when it comes to being a male in the Torah.
No, but you're not answering my question. Because my question was, I'm not denying that what you're saying. My question was, technically speaking, both phrases at face value could be referring to, seem to be talking about the same thing. That is, keeping the mitzvah. Otherwise, you wouldn't have asked. Now, Rashi doesn't answer and say, well, the Chukotai Teleichu is talking about a male in the Torah because that's what the words imply. No. But he says, the other way I know it is because the next phrase is talking about keeping the mitzvot, so then the first one, even though it appears to be that way, must be talking about some other aspect. The answer is, though, the whole source for Judaism In order for Judaism to exist, flourish, prosper, and to achieve its objective, can only be through a male and a daughter. Because, as I said, it's not just a religious system. Unfortunately, many people approach it that way, that there's different religions. So these are our religious activities, they are their religious activities, and so on and so forth. But it's completely different because it's the transformation of one's values. To transform yourself, to uproot yourself from the family value system of all the cultures, which is basically the gratification of man's fantasy. And to redirect the energy towards the achievement of the real good, which is Yetzias Hashem, which is the knowledge of God, which is the appreciation of Chachma as an end in itself. And as a result of that, to develop a certain type of an awe and a desire to get closer to the Creator, what we call Avas Hashem, that's the real good. That can only come about through our Melech B'Torah. Without our Melech B'Torah, so it's meaningless. All this is basically just a system of restraint and rules and regulations, and there's a tremendous tension.
You're saying that
you're not going to keep the mitzvah.
You're saying the chukos ba'at Eliyahu has to first go male in the Torah, because that's a prerequisite for the coming from the Torah.
That's why that must come first. Because the mitzvah cannot be performed properly, and you can't derive the real benefit of the mitzvah. You do the mitzvahs functorally, as many people do. There's many Jews that go through the motions. They perform the mitzvah. Whatever. You don't have to be a Talmud Chacham necessarily to do the mitzvah. You can do that in a perfunctory way. You get a book, or whatever. You go to a shul, the rabbi says, at a simplistic level, the mitzvahs are not that complicated. You don't have to know all the rules and regulations about matzah. You just go out and you buy a box of matzah. But that's why this is talking about something else. This is talking about achieving the state of perfection of the nation. That the nation will achieve its perfection through engagement in two types of activities. One is not enough. That's why these two ideas fit in perfectly. That is that you're unveiling myself. That's just talking about study. Like a lot of people, it doesn't mean lazy study. Of course, it does. What do you have to do? Of course, when you study lazily, you won't get anywhere in any subject. That doesn't mean that. A Malan B'Torah is different than a person goes to college and he says, serious students. That's not a Malan B'Torah. Malan B'Torah is absolute commitment to completely involved with a certain drive and energy and the ability to withstand any type of a deprivation. He's up, he's trying, he makes the effort. He's not lazy. It's a complete removal of any type of laziness. And drive to master the Torah, to achieve a certain type of a master, which means that he realizes that there's different levels and he's searching for that in-depth understanding. It's not available to superficial study. Even if it's well-intentioned, and even if it's disciplined, you got to be an amel, you really have to sink into it and pursue it and maintain a certain state of intellectual honesty. Why? For the sake of achieving, because he recognizes that this is from Hashem, and this is the ultimate good, and as a result of following the system of Hashem in the way, which is through achieving an understanding, profound understanding. A male means to achieve a level of profundity, profound understanding. Not just understanding. Today you have a lot of people, sophisticated and essays and so forth. It's sophisticated, but it's lacking a certain profundity and depth. And that can only come about through a certain commitment, which is based upon the fact that the person absolutely believes that there's a deeper truth over here. And he's not satisfied with ordinary, religious, mystical, superficial explanations. Therein lies the perfection, and with the sake of keeping the system. On that basis, he's doing it for the sake of keeping the system, obviously. That's why it's almanach. That's just two separate things. That he's now a theoretician and he likes to just pursue ideas. That in and of itself is not enough. Because since he's a human being, he has to subject his nature. He has to work on his nature and transform it. To take all of those ideas, all that knowledge and insight, and then to internalize it and to transform his emotions and develop the emotional conviction in this truth. That's the ultimate state. And then you have, when the entire nation is governed by these principles, then you have a transformed society. Then it's the Am Kodesh. Then all these blessings will come to be. Okay. That's the bracha. See, so, I mean, that's what we're striving for. Ramban's point is, you can understand why this is a very, very difficult goal to achieve. Very, very difficult. You can understand the Ramban. That to this date, we've never had a situation where the Jews reached that level. It's an exalted type of a goal. But once you have that, then the brachos will manifest themselves in a way which is unmistakable. Ramban talks about that as well. That the character of these brachos are such that they're gilui shechina, that you'll never have a situation, because no nation will have all of these different things. Any nation has some prosperity, it has some this, it has that. But for all of these things to come together in one particular nation, it'll be clearly associated with the exalted state, so it'll be a divine revelation. That's mankind. Alright, any else? We should go through, I don't have time now. Go through now the other side, the negative side. Alright, so we don't have that exalted state, but then that's another point Rashi is making, that if you don't have the exalted state, then it automatically leads to Hafaras HaBris. What's that about? Oh, I was getting that. Yeah, you see, it works by steps, though. First, the first area, just a brief word about the other side, the seventh step, that a person doesn't begin, a person ultimately becomes a kofer, it doesn't start out that way. It's in his own mind, he rationalizes. And it manifests itself in a turning away from the good, from the ultimate good, but he stops learning over. But, okay, he has excuses, whatever, he's not, in his own mind, he's not doing it because he wants to rebel against God or because he's denying God, not in his own mind. The power of rationalization is very, very great. So he has all kinds of excuses. And he's not really clear. He's not in tune with his own nature. He doesn't realize what the underlying factors are. It means, why is he turning away from Torah? Because he's drawn after other types of desires. And this is the first step. He's still keeping the mitzvot at this point. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
Huh? You want to go further or what? Staying a little bit late. You have till what, 11, 10 or?
Let me ask Danny the phone 1 second. They don't need the phone, Rabbi. If you want to go further, we can go further.
Alright, so what do you want to do, though? I'd like, maybe you should, you want to go through the seven steps and see if we can understand them step by step?
Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
I'd help you through the entire thing, though.
Can you repeat one more time what you said about Yadas not just being a system of just rote actions?
Yeah, what about it?
Could you just repeat that point and said what is it?
You see from this that the objective is to achieve a certain level of perfection. That's why it's Elihu. Now you can understand the terminology of Imbuchokosai Elihu. It's not just talking about simply to do the mitzvah, to keep the mitzvah. But Elihu means to live your life in a certain way. That's the Tzara Hashem. Statutes of God reflect the ultimate derech, the ultimate pathway of perfection. And that's the real goal. But that can only come about through two things. Through a certain attitude towards Torah, certain amala, meaning a certain jealous pursuit of the profound in-depth truth of Torah, but that also has to be for the sake of realizing that your perfection is not just in the purely intellectual part, but to actually implement it into your life and redirect all of your emotional energy to be in line with those truths. Then you achieve that state. Then you're living that life, the truly human existence that's the aim of the entire Torah.
Okay, thank you.
Is that clear?
Yeah, thank you.
I'll tell you what, maybe maybe I'll give you guys a chance to work on the other thing yourself, and we can, reconvene.
Okay.
All right?
Okay.
Part one. So, work on the 7 steps, if you can. And I'd like to hear what you guys have come up with. All right, you'll tell me how you understand it, the progression, and how that, one thing leads to the other thing, what's the idea? What's the connection? Psychology or philosophy? And then maybe we'll discuss it. I think it'll be better that way.
Okay.
When do you want to discuss it, Rabbi? When should we?
I'm setting up for seeing you next week sometime, either during the week or next Friday, whatever you think is best.
Okay.
All right, so I think it's better that way. I'll just be lecturing. All
right.
And you guys haven't had a chance to think.
Right.
That was good.
All right.
Yep.
Rabbi Man?
Yes.
Can I ask a small, unrelated question? I don't even know if it's a question.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
Why does the parsha start, right away with Nim B'chud Kosa? Isn't it usually by Deber Hashem or Moshe L'mor, ... and then it goes into this?
Well, that's not necessary.
I
have to look. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if it was a question.
Yeah. Go back to Bahar. I'm not sure. That's a technical question.
Yeah.
I'll go back to the last Vayedaber. Maybe it's a continuation, whatever. I'm not prepared to answer this. I haven't raised that kind of question yet.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's a bad question, just that.
Yeah, not for the.
Off the beaten track kind of question.
Yeah.
It's a tough question. Those kinds of questions are not easy.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else,
guys? Another question. I don't know if you can take it up though.
Yeah.
Too long. And a few times also it says, if despite this you will not heed me and you behave toward me with casualness, I'll behave to you with the fury of casualness. I don't know. I see how the Jews would be being, how they're being casual. I mean, I guess. Even that, I don't see so much, but then...
It's not really casual. The Rambam talks about this, by the way. The Rambam talks about this. Take a look at Hilchos Tainus. That's why it's a mitzvah to have a Tainus. Or, when bad things happen to the Jewish people. Because it's a recognition that it's a result of chet. And if you take the attitude of carry, the term carry means it's just an accident. If the Jew takes that attitude that it's just an accident, that's part of a hard risk. That is to say that you're saying that these things happen, there's nothing particularly here, so then God will increase it. Will increase the, hopefully the people will realize that that's foolishness. That's the idea. So casualness doesn't mean casualness the way we use it. It means that you will deny the hashgachic element. And you'll say it's just the forces of nature. And there's no special hashgacha. So that will only cause these things to get worse. And if I need, then I'll go with you with carry. Hamas carry, with an anger, with the anger, so to speak. And, until you come to your senses and realize that this is not.
So I may have just reading it wrong, but how do you understand carry with in terms of God being with his anger? How does that... Anger.
Well, it doesn't mean God is angry, obviously.
No, I know. I mean, in terms of him being carried through his... I'm not sure how that statement makes sense, with the anger of carry.
The anger of carry?
Yeah. The hamta carry. Come on.
Yeah.
This thing's still running. It's still running. Yeah, it is.
That's good, because then we have that.
I mean, it's only, right?
Now we're at 45.
Well, you know, look up from a version. There's a whole bunch of versions on what the word carry, the implication of carry. What the word means. It's not so simple. I mean, I think it's the way the Rambam learned, the way I say that, mikra. Mikra. Carry generally means mikra. That is to say that, what does it mean? It means you're going to deny. Halachti afani macham b'carry.